So next up is the exciting Azure discussion, where we'll be doing a number of demos to show off a couple pieces of Windows Azure, and then we'll actually obviously explain what it is here, but got a number of demos that may or may not succeed. So before I start off, who is doing anything with Azure today? Small handful. What about cloud in general, things that aren't Azure? Now we've, okay, handful? Okay, of course. So hey, if you haven't heard, we wrote a book. It's just came out, and you can get a discount. So this particular chapter that we're talking about from the book is around Windows Azure. What is it? How do you use it? What are the core components? So before that, this, did you need to write this down? Did you not have this? Okay. So Windows Azure is a set of cloud services for Microsoft. So it makes up a number of components. But really, before I jump into what Azure itself is, I want to kind of set the groundwork for what cloud is. Because, you know, if you ask four different people for a definition, you're going to get four different definitions. So some of it's understanding, what do we really mean by this? Is this any different than the traditional application service provider model we've had for how long now? Is cloud really anything different, or is it mostly hype, or what is it? So if you think about the challenges we all face today in IT, it's how do you scale well? You know, Ewan lives in his labs, and he talks about having his 128 cores and things like that. And one of the challenges we have is that you guys probably, like me, you look at your application on-premise today and you look at your expected load and you size it for the peak. You know, if you say, I need to be able to handle 300 messages a second in BizTalk, you size for that even if your regular load is 10 messages per second, you know, at least in the BizTalk environment. So we typically scale to the peak even though we know our data center is running at 4% every other time. So as we look at that, how do we maximize some of that existing hardware? How do we reduce the cost to add new hardware if you do all of a sudden spike it up? Does it take forever? And that's some of where cloud computing is going to come into play, which is letting you do this crazy elastic scale-up of cloud-based services. So I like this definition from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, that really it's about convenient on-demand network access to shared configurable resources, rapidly provisioned with minimal management effort or service provider interaction. So this is a particular definition a lot of people try to stick with because it's a good definition, and I bolded some of the key parts which make cloud different than your traditional application service provider. You know, one of the challenges nowadays is a number of vendors have simply preceded their current offering now with cloud in the title, and it throws people off because there's really nothing new about it. And the key is these are, as we'll talk through the next few slides, some of the real criteria for what cloud really means. And it isn't just semantics that you call it cloud, I call it this. Cloud is truly a delivery model, you know, a delivery architecture really is what cloud really means, and it's a different paradigm. So you can't just take something that was built 20 years ago and call it cloud. But at the end of the day, it's about buying compute resources as a service. So there's five characteristics that the NIST and others like to stick with when talking about cloud. First, the rapid elasticity. So this is the rapid expansion and contraction of server resources. Now, Microsoft doesn't have an offering per se in the infrastructure as a service space that we'll talk about in a second, but this would be of the model that I might have 25 servers going at the holiday season because people are buying a lot of gifts and my web traffic is high, and then at the beginning of the year, I rapidly want to scale it back down because my traffic is low. If you were a traditional shop, you probably would just have enough servers to handle your peak load even when you weren't using it. Elasticity is about rapidly throwing dozens and dozens of servers at something and then being able to quickly go back to 5 or 10 and not having to do anything special with it. So in Windows Azure, it'll do the same thing. I might want to scale my website up to a number of nodes and then scale it back down. But that's a key characteristic of cloud, which typical application service providers don't give you. Because a typical ASP, you're renting space in their data center, if you will. You couldn't just call them up and say, I need 30 more servers for the weekend. That's quite a production. The next one is the measured service. So the fact that all of your usage, whether it's network, bandwidth, whether it's storage, whether it's CPU cycles, it's all a measurable event that you get charged against. So this kind of moves away from the software licensing model. Typically, you'll hear people say that if you have to pay a license, it's probably not cloud. Because the idea is usually you're buying compute resources for a period of time, and then you're turning it off. You're not buying a three-year license for Windows. You're not buying a license for WebSphere. You're buying the time you're using it versus the license itself. So the measured service is a key aspect of a cloud solution. Next is the on-demand part. So another key part of cloud which differs from a typical ASP is the fact that it should be user provisioned. It should be, you know, Michael gets a wild hair on a Saturday and decides to spin up a number of servers. Nothing should stop him. Versus having to call up and get an administration person to build boxes and install it. You know, in a typical cloud environment, it's on demand. It's when you want it, and it's virtually instantaneous. Network access, of course, cloud computing implies it's in the internet cloud, if you will. So the idea is that really it's internet accessible and it's location independent. So it really doesn't matter where I am. All of those resources should be accessible from wherever I happen to be through traditional web channels. And then finally, the idea of resource pooling, and this is where the lower total cost of ownership typically comes from, is that I've got this multi-tenant model where I'm servicing, you know, hundreds of thousands of customers, if you will, on single instances of software. So Salesforce.com, the leading CRM vendor online, they've got 80,000 customers on a single software instance. And so everyone gets their own provision space, but you're pretty much on the same instance of software, the same database. And they're able to do this multi-tenant model, which means when they do an upgrade once a quarter, everyone gets it instantly. There's not this rollout. There's not this patching it. There's not everyone having their own version or sandbox. You know, you're doing multi-tenant. So there's upside and downside of that. But one of the upsides, it makes ownership of this a lot easier. Same with Windows Azure. You know, it's something where it's a common fabric. It's multi-tenant. You have multiple people sitting on the same servers. And it lets them drive down cost. So really, these are the five things that if somebody comes to you and is pitching you a cloud solution and they're not doing these five things, odds are they're not a cloud vendor. They're maybe repurposing an old application, or maybe they do some of these, but not all of them. So as you see with a lot of this, the whole point is it's massive scale. It's geographic distribution in a lot of these, where I might set up certain servers in the US, certain servers in the EU, certain servers in Asia Pacific, and I'm just on-demand provisioning these places. So three delivery models. The first one, your software as a service. So this is delivering software over the internet as a service. This is Google Docs. This is Microsoft Dynamics CRM Online. This is full-featured software delivered where you configure it and manage it, but you don't really manage much of the stack. You have no visibility into the underlying platform. You have no idea what the OS is. Don't know about the hardware. It's a full abstraction. You're just using the software itself. You know, at the end of the day, the provider is pretty much owns almost the whole life cycle in a SaaS environment where they're dealing with all the upgrades and the patches and things like that. The next one where, you know, a lot of folks are wondering if this is really the future of cloud computing, which is the platform as a service. This is where the fun stuff is. This is taking application platform and making that available for you to build software as a service. So this is really the underlying application environment, whether it be Windows Azure, whether it be Force.com, if you're dealing with Salesforce, the Google App Engine, all similar platform as a service offerings where you build your app using their frameworks and platform. Now, it seems that you're still abstracted away from the lowest level stuff, so you're kind of moving down the stack. When you have platform as a service, once again, you have no idea about the operating system. You don't know how much storage is there. You don't know if you're on one server with 20 people or a server all by yourself. That part is still hidden from you to some extent. Now, when you move to the lowest level, infrastructure as a service, this is kind of your bare metal. I'm buying servers, if you will. I'm configuring Windows, Linux. I'm, you know, doing things. I'm just provisioning machines at this point. Now, as you can imagine, at this point, you've taken full responsibility. It's up to you to manage your hard disk space, to set up your firewall, to set up all of your networking. As you move down the stack, you take on more and more responsibility for yourself. So this was a chart that my Microsoft friends had put together, which I liked, which again conveys that point that your responsibility as you move to software as a service decreases significantly. So the things that you manage in infrastructure in the service are things like application data, runtime, some of the middleware. As you move across, the things that you manage is getting almost nothing. I mean, when I'm software as a service, I don't manage the app. I don't manage the data. That's all owned and maintained and managed, if you will, by the provider. So it's a different model than where you've got DBAs, for example, in a SQL Azure environment. DBA has a different role. You know, the application developer, in our case, when we get to here, has a different role. We don't have to care about the OS. We don't have to care about how many virtual machines got spun up. So just an interesting paradigm for us to get used to. So Windows Azure is really what we're using to build the highly scalable, accessible, large enterprise solutions. It's made up of three components, which just to make life more interesting, because trying to remember which is which. Windows Azure Platform contains Windows Azure, which is really the web-based piece that we'll see, website-based things. SQL Azure, which is your database in the cloud. And Windows Azure App Fabric, which is meant to confuse you from Windows Server App Fabric. So when we talk about the use cases for this, and we'll recap them at the end as well, what are your use cases? Why would you ever start engaging some of these solutions? We know I asked for a show of hands at the beginning of who's doing Windows, this platform or cloud. It wasn't a whole ton. I think a lot of people are still feeling this space out and seeing what makes sense for me to throw it in here versus keep it in my own data center. So it's everything from, let's say, I need a development environment or training environment. I want to do some rapid development. I don't want to go provision all these local servers. I want to try out my application in a secure sandbox. I might spin it up in Windows Azure and deploy my local Visual Studio up to a cloud endpoint just to try things out because I don't have on-premise hardware available. Or I'm doing training. My company, we recently did training with a SaaS provider, it's a Microsoft Dynamics, and they've got an on-premise version of the software and their exact same version in the cloud offering. So instead of coming in and trying to get us all configured on-premise with the software, they just provisioned accounts for us online and we did training there. When we're done, you turn it off, no harm, no foul. I didn't spend all these weeks setting up infrastructure. Now, Microsoft doesn't yet have the virtual machine in the cloud yet. That hopefully is coming sometime soon. But if I'm using something like Amazon service, their EC2, I could give a full Windows Visual Studio environment to a contractor, let them use it for 3 weeks, and when they leave, shut it off, and I'm done with it. I didn't have to give them a laptop. I didn't have to give them all this infrastructure. So development, training, temporary environments are a good fit. Likewise, batch-oriented tasks. One thing we'll look at in Windows Azure, it's got a background processing role. So if you've got some data-intensive jobs that should be running across multiple machines, that might be expensive to provision in-house. So instead, I might upload this giant batch processing job to the cloud, let it run, and tell me when it's all done. Clearly, we talked about spiked load, so maybe I want to, one of the case studies Microsoft uses a lot is a company in the U.S. called Kelley Blue Book, which does car pricing, and it's kbb.com is the website, and they have certain spikes at certain times of year or when certain promotions run, so they actually move their whole data center and their failover from a physical data center, which was costing them a lot of money, into an Azure-based environment. So when load just spikes too much or when they need to fail over, they can just point their load balancer also to the Azure environment, and their website just scales instantly across without having to pay for the time when it wasn't using it. So if you've got a hot website that's going to be hot 3 times a year, instead you could have a very minimal amount running in your data center, and those few times a year when it spikes up, use your load balancer to also point it to an Azure-based instance, and it winds down, you turn it off, and all you do is pay for the time that it was actually running there. So those are some of those compelling cases of when you need that quick scalability, when you want to have that rapid provisioning. So let's look at a few of these. So Windows Azure is the first one, not to be confused with Windows Azure Platform. This is the short version. So the idea is you've got these multiple roles. You've got two roles, a web role, a worker role. A web role is pretty much a VM with IIS installed on it. Now, you don't really have too much visibility into that VM itself, but you actually deploy your web app, WCF service, ASP.NET application, and deploy it to Microsoft Cloud. It's fairly simple from within Visual Studio, but you can deploy that sort of web application instantly. And it's also built-in load balancer, so you try to build your apps more stateless because it's not really concerning itself too much with the individual machine it's on. It's not particularly sticky. There's also a worker role, though, which is pretty much another Azure role that doesn't have an HTTP interface. So if you want to run background processing jobs, if you want to offload things that happen on the website and then send them off for back office processing, that worker role can be chewing on data, talking to the database, things like that. So there's two roles you choose between in a Windows Azure app. Underneath all of Windows Azure is, obviously, as you would expect, a ton of servers, this fabric, if you will, that underlies it, that monitors all the VMs. If one of them gets corrupted, it'll turn it off and boot up another one for you and update the load balancer automatically. So it's a very smart underlying fabric that patches machines and spins up new instances and things like that. So you've got all the roles, you've got the fabric underneath. And then you have a lot of storage options in Windows Azure. It's something that there's probably one-to-one of many of the Windows Azure ones, the competing offerings, but it's kind of neat all within the one Microsoft stack. You have a lot of ways to store data in the cloud, and we'll look at that here next. So you can store data in tables, which I put in quotes because they're not really tables, queues, or blobs. So first, tables, and the reason it was in quotes is that they're schemaless. So this is similar to, again, some offerings from Amazon and others where it's more of this NoSQL model where I don't have a relational database underneath. I'm pretty much just storing a schemaless set of key value pairs in the cloud and accessing it very rapidly and very quickly. But I can still do link queries over my data, as I'll show you in just a moment, and use WCF data services and access it via REST URLs. So it's kind of a neat way to upload and leverage mass amounts of data that don't need the referential integrity and transactional support of an actual relational database. Partition keys and rows I just pointed out because when you create the data, you call out what partition it belongs to, and Windows Azure underneath puts similar partition data on the same servers. So if you have data that should stick together, you can tie it together, and then data that can be spread out will automatically be load balanced across. Next is queue. So this is actually message queuing in the cloud. This is sending transactional data to a queue and having someone else pull it off at some other location, whether they're your company or someone else. So this is actually doing durable messaging using Microsoft as the permanent queue between the two points. So this is one of those things, much like table storage, which really offer some interesting possibilities when you do B2B, or again, even using something like BizTalk to maybe send a message to a durable queue in the cloud where there's someone else on another company or another BizTalk server pulls it off. So some interesting scenarios there for cross-company communication. The messages live up to 1 week in the queue. You can send about 8 kilobytes in size. So it's not massive stuff, but it's almost BizTalk size. It's chunks of data that can sit in that queue for a long time. And then finally, there's blobs. So this is almost like using a file storage in the cloud, storing images, storing, you know, gigabyte video files, things like that. So those three options you have just in the Windows Azure family of things. So let's take a look at a demo of that. And I'm going to switch to not extend my desktop because I don't want to have to look at these screens all the time. Let's see if this will work. I'm sure I'm freaking them out back there on the video. Okay, that seems okay. All right, so let's jump into Visual Studio. And so what I've built is a little client application that's going to show off integration with both tables and queues. Has anyone here worked with Azure tables? Yes, I was hoping for four hands. That's good. Queues, even less? Excellent. Good. So I'm actually showing you something new instead of my BizTalk demo where you were all already knew all that. So let's take a look at this first. So the first thing you'll notice is I'm setting up some connection strings. The cool thing is that my code is identical whether I'm using the local development fabric that gets installed or whether I'm using the cloud. So one of the differentiators in the Windows and the Microsoft story is the development tooling is particularly easy to use and seamless. So what's nice is what happens when you install the Windows Azure SDK is that you actually get a local instance of the development fabric. So if I'm doing Windows Azure, I get my local version of the Windows fabric on-premise. But if I'm doing this table, queue, blob storage, I can simulate everything locally. So I can deploy it to that. I can see how it works. I can access it. I can do everything without provisioning an actual Windows Azure account. And then when the time comes and I feel like getting a bill, I can actually throw it in the cloud. But in this case, I can really test it all out before sending it up there. So as you can see, I've got all of my development storage running right now. And so by using this connection string, use development storage equals true, it's only going to hit my local development thing there. So I'm using a typed API, but everything I'm doing here is also accessible via a REST API that Windows Azure exposes. Now, of course, if I want to use type classes and make development faster, you know, I use the SDK I'm using here. But the point being, I could write any sort of app, do this over, almost through the browser, or do it from any platform to build up Azure objects. So I go ahead and create that storage account. The next step I do on my app is actually creating a table in the storage. And what I do is I pretty much, what you can do is create a table from a particular model. Now again, I mentioned it's schemaless, So it's not actually creating a table in the cloud. I can extend and contract that schema on the fly, but it just gives me a little logical model based on a data type I defined. I defined conference record, which has a list of conferences, the conference name, the conference start date, and what kind of conference it is, and my Azure application will then store all the different conferences I might attend. I'm still surprised there's no app that does this yet. I mean, if you just wanted to know which Microsoft conferences were happening in a particular month in a country, or any vendor, it's amazing that that service doesn't exist yet. So let's somebody get on that. So anyway, I'm doing at least a light version of that. So I'm building a model from that table. You see passing in certain credentials. Once I get into the cloud, the credentials matter. And then I want to go ahead and actually add rows to it. So I'm grabbing data from my little application there. I'm creating a new record. And then I'm simply adding it to that cloud object context. I'm simply adding a conference record. So let's take a look at this real quick. Let me F5 it and make a connection. I'll make sure there's nothing up my sleeve. This is my development fabric. And there is nothing in my tables. There's no little arrow next to it. So there's no tables currently in my development fabric. I'm not faking that. This is a quasi-live demo, Stephen Thomas. So let's go ahead and make a connection. It's a good first step. Go ahead and create the table for my conference object. The table is created. If I come back to here, I should see conference record now as a table on my development storage. Now, as you'd expect, there's clearly nothing in here yet. So let's go ahead and create a row. It's a technology conference. Hey, it's today. We'll go ahead and create a row, and we'll add that row there. We'll say PDC's coming up sometime. We'll create a row there. So if I come back to my development storage, which is pretty neat, is I can actually view the details of the table itself. And so I can see that table right now in my local cloud storage. And again, we'll see as I flip this to the real cloud, we'll be able to see it as well. So I can see my data there. And of course, I can retrieve that data then using, again, a REST API. If I were using web technology or if I use the SDK, I can do a lookup, and that sits there. So the nice thing is this is also persistent between running the app. So if I close my app and I run it again, this isn't purely in memory. If I come back to here and make my connection again, I should be able to look it up again. It's still there. So it's a persistent local development storage, which is pretty nice. It's not just the instance of my F5. It's not an in-memory database sort of thing. All right, so I'm going to add one more conference record just for the fun of it. Okay, a non-technology conference. Let's go ahead and close this. So back down here where I actually retrieve all that information, all I'm doing is pulling out all the conference records from my table, looping through them all, and then just adding them to that list box. Nothing particularly fancy. The nice thing is I can use link against this as well. So I wanted to get more fancy. Again, context being that pointer to my list of records. Instead of then looking at all my conference records, I could just look at my link query results. Now if I F5 this, and I make my connection, I should only pull back two records here, even though I added whatever it was, knitting yearly. Let's prove once again that this exists. So I've got three records in here, three different conferences. If I do look up that data, hopefully I only pull back two conferences. So my link query works against that cloud data source, so that is good news. Okay, so let me go ahead and delete the table. And if I go back to my cloud storage, I should expect to see nothing under my tables anymore. So let's go ahead and switch this to my cloud. So if I go back to my browser just to prove I actually have a storage account, you can go to Azure from windows.azure.com and create your storage account. And you can create either a storage or a web account and things like that. So I created a new storage account. Oh, of course, it's going to make me log in again. Oh, I love Microsoft Network. All right, so let's get back on. Oh, that's nice of it. Jump me back. All right, so I jump into my demo storage. For all of you who are watching the video later, I'm going to change this key before you can see this again. So if anyone in this room can actually memorize this key, then you are some sort of weird Rain Man. I'm not going to worry about it. So I'm going to come. Or someone with a camera. Yeah, you are a shifty bunch, so that is possible. Yeah, Yoan over here. So let me... So my account name is this. What's cool is that, so what you've seen is from the storage over there, the Server Explorer, I can also add a link to my Azure-based storage. So the fact that it looks at my development fabric doesn't preclude me from also looking at my real Azure storage. So I can put my account key in here, and it pulls in my actual account details from Windows Azure itself. So then let's at least prove that that's doing something interesting. Let's switch to use my second connection string. Once again, use the magic of F5. Let's connect now to my cloud storage. That was a connection to the real Windows Azure. And let's go ahead and actually create the table. I saw that table there already, so that seems shifty. Let me get rid of that. I don't want you to think I'm faking it, Stephen Thomas. I'm doing real demos over here. Okay, he's deleted now. Let's create him again for all you doubters out there. Yeah, I knew that was going to happen. See, I should have just faked it like Ewan. Yeah, you can see as an author team, we throw each other under the bus regularly. So that's a plus. So we'll see. Hopefully this connects. If it doesn't, I'm going to, shake my fist at it. I got my key in there. I'm connecting. I'm using my real key here. I don't think my key changed, but let's check. This will be the last attempt. Make a connection, cross your fingers, get an error. Oh. If you doubt Azure, that's when it works. So, okay, we've got conference records in there. Which one? It failing? For which? For doubting? Introduce doubt, start. You've got a TV there, so that's... All right, simmer down up there. So if we look up data, so I've got my two pieces of data, but let's more importantly, let's make sure it's actually in my cloud storage. So then this is the look into my cloud storage. Now, if I added a new... If I change my table, my conference record object, I can still upload new records of new object as well. Again, because this is a typeless schema. So I can add and remove columns, if you will, on this table. I could add new attributes of the conference record, and it would just upload perfectly fine. So that's really the value of it, that this is not looking at a relational database. It's looking at a cloud storage. So the next piece of this is the queuing part. So in the queuing world, again, the idea is that I'm going to be able to send messages to the cloud queue and then pull them off whenever I want later on. So this one's going to be similar, where once again I've got connection strings to the cloud. And now I'm paranoid about my connection string to the cloud. And once I'm again make a connection, this time though, you'll see I'm using this cloud queue client object. I'm creating a new queue in the cloud. I'm creating a queue called order queue, or create it if it doesn't exist already. And then when I want to add a message, it's pretty simple. I get the reference to the queue again, and then I simply create a queue message and populate it with a certain amount of text, or XML, or whatever would happen to be something I'm passing over there. So it's going to be text, but it could be XML representation. And then reading the queue on the other side, if this were on another partner site or something like that, or partner side, they reference the queue as well, securely, and then they get however many messages they want. So in my case, I'm getting, if I have nothing, it'll get a single message. But then I can also specify to get a number of messages from the queue. You also saw the concept of a visibility timeout, if you have superhuman vision. There's a visibility timeout. The idea behind this is if you pull something from the queue, immediately it's blocked for access by other people, but you might specify its visibility timeout is 10 minutes. So if the person reading it happens to crash or bomb out, it doesn't just sit there in limbo. It actually releases it, so now another queue reader could pull it off. So it's a similar concept to BizTalk and how the message box works with some of the heartbeats, is that if a host on a certain box pulls in, I think, an orchestration, that orchestration blows up completely. It releases it, and then it can consume on another box. So the idea is that this can unlock the message after a certain amount of time that you've specified. All right, so let's watch this work locally first. Now, the downside is I don't have a local view to queues, unfortunately. There's no way to view what's in the queue that I can tell yet. So let's go over to queuing. Let's make a connection. Go ahead and create my queue. And let me go ahead and send some, let me see how many queues I have. Okay, I have one queue called order queue. And I can create a message, it throws it to the queue, I can create another one. I can send that in. And the key is that when I read message, now I can also cancel my app. Message should still be in my queue here, that's the whole point, is I've got this durable intermediary. When I come back into my queue, I can establish my connection to the queue, and then read messages, I do get two messages back. And I do. I get this is a test, and Steven does real demos. So that's nice. That's kind of cool. It works in my local development fabric, as you might expect. Now, as you may not get, because as my demo history shows, as this should work, I'm going to switch to my cloud. And again, all I have to do is switch my connection string. All my code is completely identical. Switches to queues, make a connection to my queue, create a queue, wait for a system error. Ooh. List my queues in the cloud. I've got my order queue in the cloud. Now, technically, this is also accessible now via a public internet addressable address. So you could put this in a browser as well and do a GET and see the messages in the queue. Okay, so we make a couple of messages in our cloud queue. Once again, I can kill this. This should now be sitting in my cloud queue. And I can read the messages now from the Azure queue, hopefully, and see my messages. So, I mean, again, if you think about the scenarios for this, this could be some compelling stuff when you have, let's say, BizTalk on one side and not on the other, or you've got this communication between companies. I can have this secure queue that sits in the middle where I don't have to punch holes in my firewall or someone else's. Their apps are going and communicating between this central secure queue. That's a pretty wild way that I can be sharing information back and forth in a very durable fashion. So this is where queuing is nice, is that I might be offline for a day and a half. I come back in and connect, and I pull all these messages off. So if you've got a remote user base and they have applications, they might do some work locally and publish it to a queue. They get disconnected. They connect again later and pull it down. there could be some very interesting scenarios for how you share information using a internet addressable queuing technology. Yeah. Yeah, question is if they plan on doing SOAP-based. I can't recall if I've heard that. I mean, there's a push, I know, with some of the service bus technologies to also introduce SOAP back in with the access control service, not just REST. So I think that would be the plan. Luckily, with the SDK, for example, I don't have to care how it's communicating. But yeah, for now, REST is the protocol du jour for everybody. All right. So I'm very happy that worked. Is it OData? We're just about to see that. I'll slip you $5 later. No, but this one's not OData on the tables, I don't think. All right. So let's switch back to multi-screen. From local databases to online. So this is probably where you get more into the SQL Azure side, which, once again, you've led me nicely into the next topic. So I don't know if you'd be doing on-premise to the cloud with like table storage and things like that, because it's a bit of a new medium. But when you get into SQL Azure, the point is that I've got a true SQL server in the cloud at this point. So I can run real data migration, data synchronization, run my SSIS tasks, move data to the cloud. But with the other ones, I don't know of a migration story to get it into the table storage or the queues and things like that. So SQL Azure is the cloud-based SQL server in essence. It's pretty much a full SQL server experience, data access protocols in the cloud. So one of the benefits of this is I can use my on-premise SQL Management Studio, as I'll demonstrate shortly, in the cloud, and I can access my data, and I can run my queries, I can do all sorts of things using my on-premise tooling by simply switching my connection string. And that's the other neat thing about it is, again, if you have an application today that uses an on-premise SQL server, the only thing you theoretically have to do is switch your connection string to point to this. There's nothing else you have to do. Since this communicates over the same port, 1433, I think, to SQL Server in the cloud, literally there's nothing else you have to do to change in your app. So it's kind of a neat way that you could offload some of the data storage to somewhere else. So another nice thing, it's pay as you go. So you start off with certain database sizes and you pay for what you use. And I think the maximum size at the moment is still 50 gigabytes for an individual database. And this is where Microsoft encourages application level things like data sharding. So actually splitting the data at the application tier if you've got more than 50 gigabytes of data storage you need. And the international piece. So it's kind of nice that this already has, there's already instances of this for US, Europe, and Asia. So if you've got certain requirements where data can't leave a particular country or region, you can actually have a SQL server that lives only in the Europe space or only in the US space. So they've deployed this pretty quickly, immediately with global access. So the nice thing is it's self-provisioned. Once again, you go to sql.azure.com and you provision yourself a SQL Server database, and I'm actually going to walk through all of that. But all the high availability, all that sort of thing is baked in. So when I put something in here, it's instantly replicated. I think it's 3 times. You instantly get high availability of your data. So a lot of the infrastructure things you don't care about anymore. You're worrying more about, you know, your operations, your day-to-day is still optimizing queries and looking at your data and managing that and security roles. But you're not managing hard disk space. You're not managing that the same way. Now, this isn't full-featured SQL at the moment. You've got tables, triggers, stored procedures, constraints, things like that. But you don't have distributed transactions. You can't do CLR, stored procedures, and you can't do service broker. So that stuff's going to come in next versions. But right now, you're kind of getting your meat and potatoes T-SQL in a SQL Azure database. You're not getting the whole spectrum of on-premise SQL Server. All right, so now I'm going to make life more interesting and use Ewan's laptop to run the SQL Azure stuff because my laptop can't access all the URLs because I'm not a super secret Microsoft employee. So this is the demo that will either go horribly wrong or impress you, or maybe both because you'll be impressed by how horribly wrong it goes. Is that your password? My gosh, there was punctuation in the middle of that. Yeah, did he just turn the TV on? Did you plug it in? Good boy. He just turned off the power in the rest of the building, though. So it's a 6-1. All right. So what I want to do is actually what I'm going to build for you on this. Do you have this going on two screens? It's your crazy European laptop I have to get used to. Oh, I see. You did the same thing I did. Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, you in fair weather. There you go. He'll be here all night. All right. So what I'm going to do for you is I'm actually going to build a SQL Azure database. I'm going to... Yeah, no, I guess I should be careful because who knows what you're exposing. Going to build a SQL Azure database. I'm going to actually expose it via OData. It's a Microsoft's attempt, and I think it's getting embraced. It's a common data access protocol. So what I'm going to show is I'm going to build a SQL Azure database, populate it with some data, and then make it publicly internet addressable. So if you actually had a laptop here or whatever, you could actually hit the database, run some queries against it, all using OData. All right, so I'm going to come in here into SQL Azure. I've already got a project out here. And I'm going to start from the beginning. So I'm actually going to create a brand new database. You can see based on certain parameters, I can specify the size of a database. Is it just a simple web database? Is it a business database? Apparently, I can't have a business web database. Let's switch back to that. I'm going to go ahead and create a new database here in the cloud. Boy, that was fast. All right, so I've got my cloud database. Then I want to populate it with data. So up until now, you could use SQL Management Studio, but there's no cloud-based UI for really administering this database at all. I can't do anything on the traditional portal that lets me do things with this database, which is kind of tricky. So one thing that's fairly new is the ability to now manage it online using something within SQL Azure Labs. It's called Project Houston. So if I look at Project Houston, I can say yes, I'd like to launch it. I think my data center's here. So hopefully performance is okay. Okay, and it's going to go launch that. While it's doing that, I want to make sure I get my server name so I can access it. The nice thing over here is when you do click on your database, you can ask it to prompt you a connection string. And so I can make sure I get my server name here. Project Houston, yeah, we're going to read all this together. I totally agree to everything you've just asked me to do. Yeah, I got it. If I don't agree for you to check me out, I can't click OK. Sure. There we go. Okay, so I get the Space Age console. I can put in my server. I think my database was called CustomerDB. Trying to remember if I need all this. Let's try it out. And my password. Okay, then hopefully I can connect. Usually never works the first time, but hey, you guys are good luck. So I'm going to connect to the flashy interface here that lets me do some things on my SQL Azure database. So I've connected to my specific database, but what I want to do is create a new table in there. So I'm going to go ahead and create that. And I'm going to table one is a terrible table name. So I can have an ID column. This is a list of customers, so I might have a name. I have a country. And I might have a status for the customer. Okay, so once I do this thing, and again, this is a fairly new thing. It's nice to be able to do this on the cloud instead. Saves the data. I can go ahead and click on that table. Add some data to it. So let's put some data in our database here. Now we're going to create another one. Okay, and then finally, I'm equal opportunity. All right, so we've got three rows. And we'll make sure we save that. All right, so now we've updated data in our cloud database. So I can prove that by coming back into SQL Management Studio. And doing a new query from here. Then I can go ahead and connect to my cloud database. I'm going to want to connect to that specific database, which is not DemoDB, it's CustomerDB. Wow, so that's pretty neat. So, I mean, again, realize I'm connecting to the cloud one, even though I didn't have to do anything particularly special. Okay, so this was R2 that had that native connection. Is that right? I thought you could do it in 2008. Okay, so as you see, this is querying my table, and there were my three statuses. That's pretty neat that that worked. So the one thing I need to do is, by default, you don't do anonymous access. So what you need to do is create a role and actually or a login and associate it with anonymous login on the OData portal. So what I'm going to do is create a new account and tie it to the anonymous user in my system. So I already have an anonymous account I had created. So let's go ahead and create a new user. I'll call it the read-only user, because I already had a Sirota Anonymous account. Okay, that's good news. And I want to add that to at least the reader role, so he can't do anything but do reading. So I'm saying that this particular account can only do read operations. Oops, yeah. All right. So I created a user that is only in the read group so that if someone were doing this online using OData, all they could do is do a read. They couldn't do an insert or update. I could allow that as well if they were authenticated. All right. So let's go back online. Let's go back to, I don't need Houston anymore. Let's go back to SQL Azure Labs. And this is where you get into OData. And so again, OData, the point of OData, and SharePoint 2010 supports OData. There's a few other technologies from Microsoft. I think Dynamics CRM 2011 is going to support it. And the idea is it gives you, again, a common way to do queries against data sources and insert and update. So instead of you every time coming up with your CRUD operations for a service or data source, this automatically wraps it up with the same operations through a RESTful interface. Let's go ahead and go to this and see if this works. So I'm going to go to the OData service. Once again, I'm going to log into my database. And I can say which database is on my server, and there's my customer database. Yes, I'd like to enable OData. And then it's going to ask me which account should be the anonymous account if I'm allowing anonymous access. So again, if you see it, you don't have the Zoom. So because I have two users, I can let the DBO be anonymous, which is not a good call, or I could let my read-only user, which I just created, be the anonymous user. And then once I click this link, which is an internet addressable URL, I get my database with my customers table. So this is my query against my data here. And then I can manipulate, because OData is all about manipulating the URL. So I see that. I can also say, and customers is the table. I love when Internet Explorer does this. But I can see if I view the source when it doesn't try to put all the RSS stuff around it. I've got you in here. He's kind of okay. I've got me. I'm awesome. I've got Steven sleeping down here. So it's actually querying my database and returning it as an Atom feed. And I could do stuff like a count operation on it, for example, and get back 3 in tiny, minuscule font. But it does say 3 up there because there's 3 records in my database. But then I can also do things like I want to filter where country. I'm probably going to get the syntax wrong on this. Yeah, of course. But I can do filters based on the values, and remember how I put equals in there somehow. So I can do filters based on the actual data itself. So all of this would be through URL manipulation. Yeah, I know, you have to trust me now, and it's going to bother me that I can't get that. No, I think I need the quotes. So it's after country. Yeah, that's not good stuff. What are you going to do? Is country one of my fields? Yeah, I think so. Oh, well, we move on, because otherwise I'll be obsessed. So let's go back to one that shows data, because otherwise staring at this frustrates me. Yeah, there we go, the 3. Yeah, that's much better. Okay, so that's kind of neat. So I just took my SQL Azure database, I exposed it via OData, and now I have an internet addressable access to my database. So kind of cool thing to be able to do there. And now, just to make sure you're awake, I'm going to switch back to this side. All right. So the last piece to talk about is the App Fabric side. So Steven's going to cover this again some more tomorrow, but the other thing I want to talk about is the App Fabric service bus and a bit of the access control service. So the App Fabric service bus is really the goal of this thing is to relay messages from the cloud to services running on premises behind all your firewalls. Really, really cool technology that lets you take services on your desktop or wherever they are, buried within how many layers of NATs and firewalls, and make them internet addressable very securely to other endpoints. So you don't have to go poke holes through your VPN. I could expose an individual BizTalk receive location endpoint to a particular supplier who then wants to send it through the cloud and into BizTalk without having to do any other messy integration pieces. And I could do that today. So the whole point is that it's doing this relay from cloud to on-premise and opening that up for you. Now, the way it works is it actually creates a little bi-directional socket so that my on-premise service creates a connection to the cloud, and then the cloud point kind of hides where it's going. But then people can relay through, and that cloud has a direct connection back to my on-premise service. So if we look at that, the tricky thing today is you've got services sitting on servers, on your desktop, wherever they are. They're hiding behind machine firewalls, network firewalls, all the NAT devices, between all sorts of things. But what it's able to actually do is then your on-premise service connects to that single relay service in the cloud, creates a bi-directional, you know, it opens up that connection. And then messages can be sent here, and this guy knows how to talk back to here, in essence. It's just something that you don't see. There's nothing else that really compares to this right now in the cloud market space. As it gets more advanced, the key is really behind the covers. You actually have a lot of nodes participating in this, and there's not a lot of affinity between the machines. So it's actually a pretty nice, complex architecture that talks from the on-premise over to the service over here. So really neat stuff. So the last demo I'll show you to see if I can really pull this off is taking a service running on my desktop and executing it from Microsoft Dynamics CRM Online. So their online SaaS offering, get it to call a service on my machine. Can't be done, they say. Oh, we'll see. All right, so let's switch back to just my machine. Yes, keep changes. All right, so let's jump back into Visual Studio. Let's close all of these. And simply review the scenario real quick, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to have some on-premise business logic. And this might be a common case where you've got some key IP, key services you've built on-premise that do all sort of logic or lookups or complex algorithms. You're not ready to move that logic to the cloud. That might not make sense, but you want to make that logic accessible from elsewhere. So in this case, I've got a discount calculation service, which takes in a few criteria. What country are you from? How many employees does your company have? How long is the contract you want to sign with us? And based on that, I simply calculate what discount to give you. Now, in my case, I use a little XML file, which takes in those values and then spits out a particular discount. So what we're going to see is I can update this on the fly, and my cloud service will reflect that. So as you see, right now, if you are from the U.S., you have 100 employees or more, and a contract duration of this or more, I'll give you a 25% discount. If you're a little bigger and have a longer duration, I'll give you this. So that's what I have at the moment. My application configuration file is pretty brain dead. I have two endpoints. The first one is just your typical REST endpoint. So if you saw my contract, if you haven't done this yet in WCF, I'm specifying through this web get that I want people to just query this endpoint, not using SOAP, hitting the discount resource, but passing in country, employee count, and contract duration. So if I F5 this, oh gosh darn it, wrong app. Jump back to here. And I F5 this. My host is open. So right now I'm doing this locally. So if I jump to a local endpoint, and I hit that endpoint, I can see 25% discount for 200 employees and a 48-month contract. So let's go ahead and switch some of these values and see if I can get this to go up a little bit. Okay, so it jumped up to 35% when I added some employees. Right now, if I switch this to Sweden, I'm down to 10% because that's not in my configuration file yet. So that's what I have right now. So I have a working REST endpoint that lets you pass in things in the query string and returns a result then. So that's all well and good, but that really doesn't get you anywhere on our demo. So let's go back to my code, and I want to now enable this on the AppFabric service bus. So all I need on the AppFabric service bus side is on my appfabric.azure.com. Oh, you're not going to make me log in again, are you? Good network you guys have here. I can't insult our hosts. It's terrible form. 453. Okay. Now the machine is mad at me. All right. So if we go back to the AppFabric side, I've got one namespace. And this concept, this is more or less me registering my space in the cloud. If you went any time to richardsroeder.servicebus.windows.net, you'd get an endpoint. There's no services exposed, but I've kind of reserved this place in the Microsoft cloud. Again, you can do the same thing. So then the only thing I have to do in my code is switch my little service hoster to use the cloud URL. I'm going to print out the address in the cloud. And then I have to simply switch my configuration file to now use the cloud endpoint. So here I was just using my regular on-premise endpoint. And now let's enable my cloud endpoint instead. And this one simply uses the bindings that Fabric supports. So you'll see this one's using web HTTP relay, very similar to your web HTTP WCF binding. There's a number of bindings that match pretty closely. There's a TCP one. There's a one-way communication one. Service bus also has a neat one I showed off last year, which is the event relay binding, which lets you send one message to the cloud endpoint and multiple people could listen in on it. So kind of a pub-sub scenario where I could have multiple people attaching to that same cloud endpoint. All right, so let's do this. Cross our fingers. Hopefully this host will open. My machine is as fast as all of us staring at it, so. And hopefully once this opens, I'll switch my URL in my browser and we should be able to get the same results by hitting that cloud endpoint. Oh, that you were tense, weren't you? You were all getting nervous, much like myself. All right, so let's get back to my cloud endpoint. So again, I've got an endpoint in the world at this location. I didn't expose metadata, so it doesn't show up on my registry. But if I hit this URL, and again, this is a public internet addressable URL up there. Not messing around, that's not my machine. But as you can see, I got 25% savings for this particular combo. And this is calling, so what this is doing, again, my browser calling the cloud, which is now calling back to my laptop. So this is a service still running on my machine, but addressable from the public internet. So, to make all this magic happen, if I go to Dynamics CRM Online, so this is Microsoft Dynamics, their CRM tool. They've got an online version, which is the same software as their on-premise version. And I can go to the, I built a little custom object in CRM. Because I want to allow people to enter contracts in the online version of the application. But I still want to use my on-premise business logic to give people discounts. So in this case, I'm going to go ahead and create a new contract. Again, I want to leverage that on-premise knowledge. All right, so I have a few fields here I need to fill out. Contract duration, let's say it's 24 months. When I tab out of this, Dynamics lets you have an on-change event. Hopefully it's going to populate the discount percentage. Oh, good times. So it populates 25% there. So on the on-change event in Dynamics, it went and called my local service and returned 25% for this. So let's say I do change this, though, from 24-month duration to 36 months. Calling the cloud service again. Hopefully the discount percentage jumps up to 35. And it just did. Look at that. Now, of course, we need to make sure I'm not completely faking that. So let's go back to my service and go to this XML file I've got. And let's just show some love to our hosts. Can't have this US-centric model. That's not at all friendly of me. And you can have less people because you are important here. Let's have some 65 action. And let's do that. Now, all I'm going to do is save that configuration file. If I go back to, again, the online hosted app, and there I have no idea. Let's jump back to here. If I change this value to, let's say, even just 40, hopefully this comes back at a 65% discount, even though I just live changed my endpoint. And there you go, 65%. There you go. So that's pretty neat stuff. That's an online. I mean, I could do the same thing from Salesforce.com. I could do that from any online hosted app. So I'm reusing my on-premise business logic, even though I'm using a cloud-based app. And again, the same thing could be this could call into a BizTalk endpoint exposed through App Fabric, and it does a complex workflow and then returns a result. Or you saw from even Steven's work and others that I might do an aggregate workflow service, expose that via the cloud. So I think the key is I can exploit on-premise knowledge and logic but still expose it through the cloud to cloud apps or the cloud partners. So I think the point of all of that is that, you know, Azure at this point, everything's been released. Everything's V1 in the most case, but it's a fairly complete set of tools. You've got Windows Azure for all your websites. You want to throw an ASP.NET app out there, WCF service. You've got SQL Azure, as we saw, where I can expose databases and expose real data in the cloud. And then you have App Fabric, which really exposes on-premise resources through a cloud relay, which, again, is a fairly interesting thing that opens up things you just couldn't do before. So that's where when people talk about cloud being just rehashing things we've been doing for a long time, I don't think that's the case. I think this is what's opening up new business models. It lets a company who is starting in a garage start off with enterprise scale infrastructure because they're using the cloud and they don't want to go buy 1,000 servers. I can build my Facebook app. I can go ahead and build an interesting startup and I don't have to provision a huge data center now. Or in our case, we can do some cool enterprise things and share data in ways we simply couldn't do before. So there you go. Thanks.